The following podcast contains explicit language.
This is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, here with a Slate spoiler special on Paul Greengrass's new film, Captain Phillips. And joining me from Slate's D.C. office is Slate's political correspondent, Dave Weigel. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Dana.
Thanks for coming in to talk to me about this. We've only done one spoiler before. It was World War Z, and it was one of my favorite ones I've done in a while. So I'm hoping you'll bring some insight to Captain Phillips as well. Before we get started, I wanted to hear a quick, just overall response. Did you like this movie? Would you send friends to it?
I really did. I was surprised I liked it this much because I blow hot and cold when it comes to Paul Greengrass. I enjoyed You Died in 93, although it was painful to watch. And at the time, I remember the political context was kind of ominous because it was when George W. Bush was still president and he was trying to remind people that you should be scared of terrorism and vote for him. This has no political context. Maybe that was a little bit more helpful. And I found it really, really thrilling. I've been told to go watch A Hijacking, which is also about an incident like this. That is less Hollywood, but this didn't feel terribly Hollywood apart from the pulse pounding music. I mean, this was a classic Paul Greengrass, I have no idea how to hold my camera steady, thriller with a story I'd forgotten about. I mean, I mentioned in 1993. We all remember what happened on 9/11. We never forget. I'd kind of forgotten the details of this story and didn't really bone up beforehand. So I was pretty captivated.
Yeah, the story, if people don't know already from the previews and all the hype this movie has gotten, is it's retelling this real-life incident from 2009, I think it was, when a U.S. cargo ship was hijacked by Somali pirates. And in real life, the incident, as I recall, took several days, right? It was like 5 days that first the ship was held hostage and then the captain was taken to this lifeboat. And the movie telescopes it down to what seems to be about a day.
Right. I mean, I actually met the Captain Phillips at the D.C. premiere of this. And he, you know, I asked him afterwards how close it was. He just said, it was a movie. he wasn't trying to pretend it was that close to the experience.
Right. It's based on a book he wrote.
5 days of waiting around, I think, would have been interesting. The movie just takes you, by compressing it and making it all happen in what feels like, I mean, less than 36 hours, because there is a kind of countdown once they get going about how little time they have before Phillips gets to sea. But I'm kind of skipping around the plot, and which is weird because it's not even that complicated of a plot. I mean, do you want to go through what people can expect?
Yeah, it's very, very simple. I mean, in terms of what happens in the story, it's extremely simple. I would argue maybe almost too simple. I could have used a little bit more differentiation of, for example, some of the other characters, the crew members and some of the lesser hijackers. There's really only one hijacker that you get to know at all, the leader of the group, whose name is, I think, Muzi? Muzi? Is that how they pronounce it?
Muzi, yeah.
Muzi.
It's spelled Muse when I've seen it, but Muzi. Who is very good. He's the kind of actor you wonder what else he could be cast in, because he's a Somali immigrant. I think he's from Minnesota, where a lot of Somalis ended up. Who is just terrifying looking when he wants to, when he's not trying. There's I think a pretty good trick done by Greengrass to make him the most sympathetic character, because I did like that he plays with our sympathies. This who we might naturally find to be the most likable of the pirates. In the trailer when this was coming out, I mean, there's a moment that's also very effective in the movie when he's kind of patronizingly asserting his control over Captain Phillips. Goes, relax, look at me, I'm the captain now. And he's, kind of bug-eyed, his teeth are a little bit crooked. The rest of the crew look a bit more, ready for a Die Hard sequel than this guy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea in that very early scene, the one scene that you actually see in Somalia at the very beginning, the same thing happened in United 93, actually. There was a very brief setup of the hijackers at the beginning. And I think it's implied in that scene, essentially, that even among these really desperate, hardscrabble guys who are fighting, with these warlords for the right to be on this hijacking team, that he's one of the most desperate of all, right? He's the one who gets nicknamed Skinny, even though they're all unbelievably skinny. And he seems to be the one who, maybe is the most unlikely of the hijackers.
He is, and I thought that was a little bit obvious. But let's start at the beginning of the movie, which seems natural.
Wait, I just want to throw in one thing, just for the sake of that actor, just that his name is Barkhad Abdi, and confusingly, another hijacker, the young hijacker who cuts his foot later, remember, is played by a person with almost exactly the same name, Barkhad Abdi Rahman. If you add Rahman, he has the exact same name. So maybe that's like the Joe Smith of Somalis.
Oh, I hope they don't accidentally nominate the wrong guy for the Oscar. To start in the beginning of the movie, I thought it was a little bit pat, but, effective. So it begins with Captain Phillips literally, I think, closing his laptop and getting ready to go on this mission around the Cape of Hornet of Africa. Sorry, I almost said the Cape of Good Hope, and that would have been embarrassing. look less at it anyway. So he's setting up his wife, played by Catherine Keener, and him have this really kind of NPR-ish discussion in the car about how, boy, things are really changing these days. It's so much harder to get along. It's going to be tough for our kids in this world that's changing so much. And then we cut to Somalia, where they're not actually having that discussion, but clearly things are much worse than they are in Vermont, where Kim Fields is from.
Did you think that that discussion in the car? I mean, I have a few problems with this, with the family setup in this movie that we can get to. I mean, part of it is just, why are they putting Catherine Keener in the movie when she's literally in it for about 90 seconds? You know, I spent the rest of the movie thinking, when are we cutting back to the people at home? And we never do. But also, yeah, this conversation they have in the car seemed to me one of the moments when Greengrass really is setting things up in a little too parallel of a fashion. You say this movie doesn't have political content, and overtly, I guess it doesn't, but it does seem to be making some sort of point about, you know, globalization and the world economy and desperation, and that's, I think, all being set up in a way by this conversation in the car about, you know, our kids aren't going to have the security that we had.
Mm-hmm. And in Somalia, they don't have the security at all. They are at the mercy of pirate overlords who are forcing them to make as much money as possible or be probably shot. So it is very sympathetic, and I can see if this movie becomes popular, a backlash forming over how sympathetic it makes the hijackers. There is Muse, there is the young kid who cuts his foot, there's another guy who's kind of has less personality, and there's a crazy person. And you do get the impression, you're left with the impression that the crazy person in the hijacking crew who is always arguing that Muse is too soft and arguing it's time to kill the hostage, that, boy, if everyone had been a bit more level-headed, this couldn't have gone that way, which seems a little bit too easy. It is didactic. I mean, I didn't mind as a viewer being told to get inside the head of Somali pirates, though, because they are among the least understood people on the planet. I mean, you hear pirate and you have to think a little bit harder to imagine the Somali pirates. And then what do you know about Somalia beyond a couple of cliches? So I didn't mind it, but that is what the impression you're supposed to be left with the movie is not. Was this also a complaint people had about Unite 93? You're a little bit too much inside the heads of the terrorists. You know, you see them cast a look at each other as they know the plane's going to go down. They failed.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The idea that it wasn't that it was at least neutral, you know, even that it was neutral and the terrorists were regarded as human beings and not shown as sort of just a faceless menace. I think maybe especially because that was so close to 9/11. It was only 2005 when that movie came out. Mm-hmm. I think that was a problem for people. But I can actually also see the left taking the opposite tack on this movie and saying, you know, the Somali pirates are presented as this sort of like, you know, dark menace from the continent and that they're too undifferentiated. And I think the differentiation might work a little bit better if Paul Greengrass would just slow down and keep his camera still once in a while. I guess I haven't mentioned yet my overall feeling about him. And I sort of find that although he can be a very effective filmmaker, the Bourne movies are great. United 93, I have my objections to its sort of existence and placement. And mm-hmm. I don't know. I did not love United 93, but it's very effective. It certainly makes your palms sweat and makes you feel like you were on Flight 93. And he is really great at that immediacy and that kind of faux documentary filmmaking. But it's kind of exhausting. I mean, there's moments where he takes it too far. And that happened in this movie for me, too, because even a documentary cameraman tries to keep his camera still, right? I mean, it's only in the middle of combat or some kind of action that there's this jiggly effect. And there's moments in this movie where you're looking at just a dial on the ship's dashboard, and the camera is still wildly jerking around. I think the only moments that there was sort of enough peace that you could orient yourself in space and not be behind the jiggliest camera possible were some of those aerial shots, you know, when you're seeing later on when the Navy SEALs come in and there's a big Navy ship and you're tracing that and the lifeboat and various craft. Just because they're aerial shots, there has to be some sort of stillness. And to me, that was just a moment of respite from this constant, crazy camera work. And I'm not complaining that it makes me nauseous or dizzy or something. I just don't think it always tells the story as effectively. It's not necessarily suitable for every single scene.
But you're bringing up something interesting. I guess I get to it by explaining exactly what happens, because I feel like the reason this might be even sort of spoilable is it did happen 4 years ago, and most people have forgotten the details. I mean, we've had since then the much more well-known and dramatic killing of Osama bin Laden. So what happens is Captain Phillips is rounds the Horn of Africa. Pirates attack. They evade them once, and I thought that scene was quite effective. I had forgotten that they got to invade them once. They evaded them once with a couple of tricks and the usual ship security measures. The pirates come back. They board them that time, and Captain Phillips is able to, with the help of the crew, who are all portrayed as a little bit cowardly but very clever, injured the pirates so much they just retreat, but they take him as a hostage. So the last act of the movie is all alternating between Captain Phillips in a very rinky-dink-looking, well, actually sturdy but silly-looking lifeboat, this orange dinghy kind of hanging out that looks like it's made out of the fiberglass of the that a bottle recycling canister is made out of.
And it's enclosed, we should mention. A lifeboat you think of as being some sort of raft open to the sea, but this is almost like a child's boat with a top on it, which really adds to the claustrophobia of that second half of the movie when he's Tom Hanks is trapped in the boat with the four pirates.
So there's this quiet and claustrophobia and a pretty good sense, it's a good sense of space, although he doesn't quite show you, there's nothing he quite shows you the entirety of. Even on the boat, you're kind of, there's one a diagram of where things are in the boat, but even in the little lifeboat, which is very small, you are aware as Captain Phillips is aware of the design. So there's a point when he goes to get water, and there's a point when he is telling his possible rescuers what seat he's in case they need, which is he's very well drilled. I mean, he comes off much better than any normal human would come off in this situation. He says that he's in seat 15, so hint, hint, they should, if they need to invade the ship, they should go to seat 15, or they should avoid seat 15. But what I was trying to get to was that everything's shaky except for these very badass heavy shots of the Navy SEALs coming to save him, which are, I think, the most stable things in the film. The people rescuing Phillips put out this call. The Navy SEALs, first they come from Virginia, so they cover the entire ocean, and there are these very kind of loving shots of the SEALs getting on the plane and then boarding the plane.
Jumping out of the plane?
Getting onto the cruisers, then jumping out of the plane to another cruiser, then suiting up again, then staging for their sniper action. And it was the only... I was wondering if he was trying to be more fair after giving us so much about the details of the pirates. I didn't know because we don't learn as much about how the pirates operate as we do about the Navy SEALs, and we just see them. They're almost shots that remind me of the Right Stuff, of these amazing buff guys with their guns walking not in slow motion but walking in formation, ready to finally rescue Captain Phillips. They're the only people in here who are presented as in a state of complete calm.
Yeah, you're right. And the camera is in a state of calm when it regards them most of the time as well, which is maybe a gesture of kind of veneration of the military on Griffith's part, or maybe just the simple fact that he was filming something so big that he had to keep his camera stationary, right? I mean, when he's trying to get some big panorama, you don't just want to see, half of one of the Navy SEALs' cheeks. You want to actually see what they're doing. Mm-hmm. I actually have a question about that as a reporter. Are Navy SEALs really that big? They just seemed so buff. They didn't seem like they'd be able to sort of run fast or get in and out of small spaces. Like, were the guys that got Osama bin Laden just worked out like that?
I mean, they can run pretty fast if they're taught. There are a couple of guys who are a bit bulkier who maybe couldn't, but no, they all seem to be in great shape. It's just they're in contrast to the kind of average to flabby members of the crew. And, Tom Hanks is in normal Tom Hanks shape, looks like a normal guy, and the very skinny pirates. There are these guys who are completely alpha maled up who are able to save him. And we also, I think why it struck me is I don't think we really get to meet any of them except for one guy who participates in a ruse to slow down the ship so that they can come and shoot them, so they can come and shoot the pirates. We do meet one of the Navy SEALs as a very successful and thoughtful operator. The other guys are just kind of ciphers in a way that the crew members aren't. We get to know a lot about the crew members and quite a lot about the pirates.
Yeah, see, I could have gotten to know a little more about both. I think, again, this is partly a casualty of just the speed with which Greengrass's camera moves and with which his story moves. United 93 had a little bit the same problem for me. I mean, for all that it was pulse-pounding in terms of, oh, shit, I know this plane is going to go down and it's going to be horrible, you had no idea who anyone was on the flight. And I know that was kind of deliberate, but to me, it makes it alternate in between, this is sickeningly suspenseful and this is kind of boring. And that happened a little bit in Captain Phillips as well, especially after he ended up in the lifeboat. I mean, obviously, there's a very basic, please don't shoot Tom Hanks, right? Nobody wants Tom Hanks to die. But knowing that Tom Hanks is not going to get shot because he went on to write a book about it, which became this movie, there were some moments that it just sort of seemed to me like it's just jiggly cam inside a boat, for a solid hour.
Yeah, that's a good point. I feel I kind of forgot how he got out of it. I mean, I don't know if he was injured in some way. There are elements of it that are clearly not going the way he expected. So there is suspense in that scene, but I felt like the moments when they're confronting the pirates are just... I like them because, frankly, I don't know that much about how Fighting Pirates works in the year 2013, or in this case, the year 2009. And it's interesting to see how this gigantic ship uses its defenses, the hoses that make it impossible to get close enough to board, the trick. He has a really fun trick of faking a call to one of the maritime police organizations that's currently on, like giving a busy signal, where he holds his phone up to the receiver and says, "Oh, we're receiving you." That was kind of fun. The part that was supposed to be incredibly suspenseful, I felt, was a little bit duller.
What you mean the lifeboat?
The lifeboat
stuff toward
part.
The end.
Yeah, I kind of knew how that was going to end. I didn't know how he was going to get onto the lifeboat as much as that.
That does become incredibly tense at the very end, though. Mm-hmm. I will say that there's a little bit of slack time in that lifeboat. Again, to me, partly just because I was not really aware of the geography of the lifeboat or who was who or what was going on where. But at the end, when the snipers finally do get a clear shot on the three pirates, do they kill? Yeah, because at that point, one of the pirates, Muzi, the main guy, is...
Yeah, Muzi is the most rational one they pull onto the boat as part of the ruse to... say that they're going to. It makes very little sense. The one thing I think he does convey is that at this point the pirates are kind of scrambling and don't know what they want. They almost remind me of the House Republicans that I'm covering right now. All right, we've got a hostage.
We have no idea what to do with them.
Maybe. Well, give us something. That's what we want.
But except
yeah,
the hostages.
They pull
us.
Them onto the boat in this ruse that they will give them some kind of ransom or something and let them reunite with their elders, their tribal elders, and instead he gets to go to prison and everyone else gets shot.
Right. The elders thing seemed like such a transparent ruse. It seems like they would at least name, right? At this point, they had figured out who these guys were and what village they were from, and they could have said, we're getting so-and-so-and-so-and-so. The fact that the word elders kept being thrown around in this vague way seemed like it would have been a tip-off.
No, they spook them by knowing exactly who they are. They can name all of the people on the lifeboat, and they all get scared. This, I think, was pretty effective, too. I'm saying I was less into the suspense than I was into how they told the story of this weird area of the world that is completely lawless, but when the hand of the government needs to crush people, it can. I liked how spooked they are when it's clear the American intelligence has learned their identity so quickly. And I did like the shots when it pulls out and you see the lifeboat surrounded by three gigantic American cruisers and carriers. You kind of get this reminder of how completely helpless the Somalians were. I think that was Greengrass's point. I'm not sure what stance he's taking on whether we should sympathize with them.
But I did talk
to Captain Phillips at this premiere. I mean, that was what I was curious about. Did he mind watching these Somalians be portrayed so sympathetically? And he kind of dodged it. He said, well, there wasn't actually that much dialogue between us and then. They yelled at me a lot, and I stayed pretty quiet.
Right.
But I think he dodged the question to be polite.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm really curious that you find it so sympathetic. I think I would have to watch it again with an eye to, let me see if they're being portrayed sympathetically or not, because so much of my cognitive space was just devoted to trying to figure out what was happening and, kind of dealing with the suspense part of it. I mean, I would say, yeah, that there's a sense of understanding their motivations, especially in that early scene when they're scrambling for the spot. And later on when Tom Hanks says to one of them in the lifeboat, are there any other options besides being a fisherman or a pirate? And then the guy says, maybe in America there are.
Yeah.
Right?
That was a little on the nose, but I got it.
Yeah. I mean, all those moments in this movie were pretty on the nose. But that's the thing. If it's going to happen in the midst of chaos, right, it's sort of like chaos, 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 and then, some on-the-nose pinpoint bit of dialogue that tells you exactly what's going on. And that seems a little bit like the Greengrass structure that I don't always love. But, I mean, when the three guys on the boat get sniped at the end and they all, just basically explode over Tom Hanks, I mean, there is a little bit of a Osama bin Laden feeling of like, yeah, we got him. I mean, don't you think that you feel that in the movie wants you to feel that?
I less so than with bin Laden. I mean, even though there are screaming women and children in Zero Dark 30 that are supposed to make you feel nervous, these pirates, we know that bin Laden was pretty wealthy and didn't need to lead this life of terror. You're left the impression that these pirates, had they been born even in, Kenya or something, not that far away, might have had a different lifestyle. So when they're shot, you are, you feel kind of cold, and there's a nice, I think if this gets discussed for acting awards, it'll probably be because of the last 5 minutes. After Captain Phillips survives, he is just in shock and babbling, and I don't know if he gets an entire sentence out. And he's shot, he's saved, he looks around, he's splattered with blood, he has no idea what's happening.
He's actually blindfolded, right, at first.
Well,
that's really effective.
First.
So he doesn't know whose blood is on him or who's dead or what. It's just suddenly silent.
Mm-hmm. He's blindfolded. The Navy SEAL snipers that have been built up so far are, despite a very kind of video gamey sequence where they are trying to line up three shots at once with green and red on the screen, you know, we've got two green, we need three. They completely succeed. All the terrorists are dead, including the young boy who had cut his feet, who seemed pretty blameless in the whole thing. And Captain Phillips is, you know, at that point, had been blindfolded and maybe was going to be killed if the SEAL didn't act. And he's just confused and devastated and scared. There's not, you know, in a fictionalized, cruddy Michael Bay version of something like this, when he confronted the Muse, who is on the boat, they probably would have given him a chance to confront him and, you know, uppercut him or something.
Right, or he'd be like kissing the heroine on the deck in the last scene or something like that. Yeah, I have to say that was one of the most powerful things in this movie. I think the ending was incredibly well done, both by Tom Hanks and just the way Greengrass filmed it. And just that idea of ending on that beat, right? Ending an action thriller on a beat of a person in shock who's, you know, kind of completely incoherent and weeping.
Yes, I thought that was... We have not seen many movies that end like that, because he has been remarkably resilient. And that's the point, I think. He's remarkably resilient. He makes a bunch of decisions in the heat of the moment that save his crew. He never seems to make a mistake, really, as he's plotting this. I mean, they are only boarded because one of the hoses that's supposed to block the pirates from coming up is not working. You get the impression, had that been working, it might have gone differently.
Right. Yeah. No. He's shown having a huge amount of foresight about it too. Right.
Yeah.
As they're about to pull out of their initial port, he's saying like, "This is a pirate-ridden area, and you know we have to lock down the entire ship." And they make it very clear that he takes every precaution he could.
Yeah. And so at the very end, when he breaks down, it's good. I mean, it's predictable in its way, but it's, you know, infinitely preferable to the ending of most movies where there's a Aerosmith song on the soundtrack and people are making out and the villain has fallen to his death or something. It's very grim. You leave the experience kind of getting this. I kind of left it with this idea of how much American power can crush a threat if it's in the right place, and of the pathetic nature of the pirates and of how, you know, Phillips' story is inspiring, but he's not, you know, it's like he's kind of like John McClane, except John McClane breaks down in tears at the end because it was such a harrowing experience.
Yeah, I thought that was really great. I mean, to me, that was very unpredictable, at least as a kind of, you know, emotional affect to end on, that a hero doesn't have to be, you know, the guy who's kissing Kelly McGillis on the deck at the end, you know, that it can be the guy who's experiencing actual trauma.
That's what left me leaving the movie in a mood to recommend it. I just feel like I haven't seen that very often, and... Even in a real life story like this, I mean, is it a little bit too much like Zero Dark Thirty, though, where at the moment of triumph, our agent looks at the body of Osama bin Laden, then goes into a hangar and collapses into tears? It's a bit like that, I guess, except that was 10 years of pain and memories coming back to haunt her, whereas this is just pure shock. And I think I like you never see somebody survive the situation and collapse. I mean, our frame of reference is James Bond defusing the bomb and then getting to, you know, ship somebody in a life raft, right? It's not, thank God I survived, I can't believe all this blood is on me, I'm going to weep in the arms of a doctor right now.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's an interesting connection to Zero Dark Thirty, and you're right, maybe that'll be the new cliche, like the weeping tough guy or girl at the end of the movie. But it's very different in terms of, you know, the direct physical trauma that he's just experienced, right? I mean, it would be like one of the SEALs at the end of Zero Dark Thirty suddenly breaking down and weeping. I mean, I will say that during that last hour when we're trapped in the lifeboat, like I said, there were some moments when I started to feel a little bit too much like Tom Hanks, like, get me out of here, get me out of this movie, right? But but I was crying along with him at the end. I thought that was really, really effective, although I sort of wish the doctor had hugged him. He so clearly needed a hug.
No, there is a great, and I think it's hopefully because Greengrass is a journalist. I'd love it if journalists were just really good at this kind of thing and giving us making the profession look good. But he just portrays everyone in the military as completely knowing their roles and being professional, and the doctor's being very professional, has a script and that she's working to. And there's no one ever offers a perfect one-liner, which is kind of nice. I like that part of the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, there's not really many quotable quotes in this movie. It's really not about that. And as you and I have mentioned, like, the few bits of memorable dialogue that there are usually a little bit obvious, and, you know, they're not necessarily memorable in a good way.
The only one I found memorable was from the trailer, and it's Tom Hanks in his affected Vermont accent going, "They now hit a fish."
What did you think of his accent and his performance in general? Would you like to see him get an Oscar for this, or get at least nominated?
I wouldn't be offended if he was nominated. I'm just leading as much as I can on the fact that I went to this DC event with the real Rich Phillips, who was, you know, really, really game. I mean, it's nice to meet these people who are famous for something they actually achieved, and he was aware of that. And as he talks, as he talked and as he just stood there, I was impressed. I mean, Tom Hanks really did a good job. Apparently, they kind of hung out for a little while for Hanks to get the patois right. It is a you know, New England, Vermont accent with Irish inflections that you never really hear. It sounds odd. I think Hanks mostly gets it. At the end, when he's breaking down, he's not quite doing it. But for when he's any kind of dialogue, he's got this good flat voice, almost a monotone, and that is how the guy sounded. It was solid. But I was much more impressed by the acting of the Somalians, of the. Guys who, I mean, it's even striking when you go to the credits. Either the credits start rolling, and it's Tom Hanks, hard to pronounce Somalian name. And I thought that was all good, and I'm better than a lot of movies I've seen. You know, I can see conservatives getting very angry about this, or people feeling like it's not American exceptionalist enough. But I really did. I thought those guys were extraordinary. I hope they get some more roles that are not just them playing the worst people in Somalia.
Right. Yeah. That would be a bummer to be a Somali-born American actor and feel like all I get to do is, you know, hold knives to people's throats and scream on screen.
No, I generally think this is a good way to do the real event film. I mean, Greengrass has a couple of things that already seem like cliches that from the movies we've seen so far. I think they worked pretty well here. I would enjoy seeing him adopt a few more stories that took place over 3 days with a ton of action. When he expands to something like Green Zone, I don't think it's very effective. He does tend to be didactic, and you can only be so didactic if it's a 36-hour period. So, you know, more of that. This is pretty good at conveying a problem in the world, hammering you over the head very gently, but not leaving like you've been lectured to.
Yeah, I agree. I think along with Bloody Sunday and the first two Bourne movies, this is my favorite Paul Greengrass movie. Green Zone was a moment that I really started to give up on him, and I do think so many people have imitated that style now. He can do it better than anyone else, but still, it really has become a visual cliche, and I think he needs to start learning to do something with the camera that involves composition, apparently, or once in a while, or beauty, or something besides, like, I'm just going to stick this in the most unflattering angle possible and shake it around.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Dave, thanks so much for joining me, and please come spoil another movie very soon.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Our producer is Chris Wade. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Andy Bowers. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.